WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. If there's a true zealot in the battle against steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs in sports, it's our guest, Dick Pound. He calls athletes who stoke their performances with drugs the sociopaths of sport, cheaters who respect neither their fellow competitors nor the games they're playing. Pound was an Olympic swimmer for Canada in the early 60s and has been a member of the International Olympic Committee for 25 years. In 1999, he founded the World Anti-Doping Agency, which has worked to develop a single list of banned substances, as well as testing protocols and uniform punishments for those caught doping. The agency has had considerable success in amateur athletics, but Pound has harshly criticized pro sports for moving slowly on the issue. Pound's blunt comments about drugs in sport have embroiled him in several public controversies, most famously with champion cyclist Lance Armstrong. Dick Pound's new book is called Inside Dope: How Drugs Are the Biggest Threat to Sports, Why You Should Care, and What Can Be Done About Them. Well, Dick Pound, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, you were an Olympic swimmer, competed in the 1960 Olympics in Rome. Do you think the athletes around you then were doping?
Certainly not in swimming. I think there was some indication that, you know, the weightlifters had already got into the steroids, and I think the field folks, you know, the shot putters and discus throwers in track and field. But beyond that, certainly not to my knowledge. It hadn't spread generally to other sports.
Well, Dick Pound, it's interesting, I think, for a lot of people to observe that your organization, the World Anti-Doping Agency, is a relatively young thing. I mean, this really came out of scandals in the late 90s. What prompted the formation of the World Anti-Doping Agency?
Well, I think the real key event was the 1998 scandal in the Tour de France, when Festina team was caught with industrial quantities of doping substances and equipment and so forth, and were arrested by the French police. That was kind of a wake-up call for the European-based international sports federations, who said, gee, if this can happen to cycling, which is a very popular sport, in its blue ribbon event, the Tour de France, this could happen to my sport. And I don't want to see that happen to my sport. So that was one element of it. The other element of it was that, unfortunately, the then president of the International Olympic Committee, also watching all of this stuff on television, says, for me, this is not doping. You know, unless you can prove that whatever it is actively damaging to health, I don't think it should be called doping, and I think the IOC list is too long, and on he went. Having forgotten that he'd invited a Spanish journalist to be with him for the day, you know, to see how Juan Antonio runs world sport, that sort of thing. And this guy could hardly believe his ears, because everything was on the record. He's writing it all down as Samaranch is saying this, and the next day out it comes in the Spanish media. And that produced an absolute firestorm of public attention and criticism about the IOC, and the result was, we said, look, you know, nobody trusts the individual sports to go after their riders or players. Nobody trusts particular countries to be hard on their own athletes if they catch them doping, and nobody trusts the IOC anymore. So what we need is an independent agency that's not controlled by any of these stakeholders to kind of take charge of this on a world level, and also to recognize that while sport can do a lot of things, you know, we know who the athletes are, we know where they are, we know pretty well what they're doing, we know who their coaches are, we know who the bad coaches are, you know, that sort of thing. But there are a lot of things we can't do. I mean, we can't prevent trafficking in drugs. We can't enter into premises and seize evidence. We can't compel the giving of evidence under oath, and a whole bunch of things that only governments can do. So the solution has to be a combination of sport plus the public authorities.
You know, one of the stories that you tell in the book is that of the sprinter Kelly White. You go into that in some detail. Remind our audience of her experience with doping and the lessons you think it bears?
Well, Kelly White was one of the American sprinters who was caught up in the famous Balco affair. Her initial brush with doping came out of the World Championships in 2003 in Paris, when she tested positive for a stimulant, a quite a strong stimulant called modafinil. And the explanation that was concocted for this was, first of all, that it wasn't a stimulant, which is wrong. It is a stimulant. And secondly, that she was taking it for a condition called narcolepsy, which meant that she could fall asleep without warning and in, you know, circumstances that might be dangerous. You don't want to have somebody with narcolepsy driving a car because they could fall asleep at the wheel. It turned out on examination that of course, she did not have narcolepsy. There was a doctor produced by the Balco people who said that he had met with her four times as a patient and he had prescribed modafinil as required, like she had a few little pills of this stuff available for this so-called condition of narcolepsy. Kelly White said she'd never even heard the word until it had been mounted in her defense. And it was so obviously a preposterous position. I mean, was she going to fall asleep sometime between the start of the 100 meters and the finish, you know, over the course of an 11-second race? I mean, it didn't make any sense. So she got disciplined for that. And then, of course, her name turned out as part of the big THG scandal. And this was one of the designer steroids that was discovered. And she was one of the users. And when confronted with this, she agreed to accept a suspension for having used that. But she came and spoke to the World Anti-Doping Agency Foundation board a couple of years ago just to describe how this happened, how her coach basically pushed her into doing this and introduced her to the guy that ran Balco.
Balco being and the Bay Area lab that was the source of doping for a lot of athletes. Yeah.
And she was introduced to Victor Conte, who supplied this stuff to her. But the scary part of it was this was stuff that was going straight from a laboratory into the system of athletes with nobody having done any testing to see what the side effects would be. And she had, I mean, aside from the acne and all of that sort of stuff that you get from steroids, she was having, two menstrual cycles every month, and she had blood pressure that was going through the roof. And these folks had no idea. They'd say, oh, well, maybe you should take a little less or, drink some more water, stuff like that. It's probably a miracle that some of those athletes didn't die from what they were being given.
You mentioned that she had explained the presence of this stimulant, or people had explained on her behalf that it was for this condition, narcolepsy, this, spontaneous falling asleep, and that she said she not only did she not have it, she'd never heard of it. Did the doctor who offered that explanation suffer any repercussions from this phony defense?
Not to my knowledge. No, that's part of the difficulty in the whole doping issue is that, to date, 99.9% of the people who bear the brunt of sanctions are the athletes, and the enablers get away.
One of the things you write about are some of the creative techniques that athletes employ to hide doping. What are some of the more innovative things we've seen?
Well, there are masking agents. Of course, there are making yourself unavailable for out-of-competition testing. There are, you use the substances and the methods prior to competition, and you do it, far enough in advance that the stuff has cleared your system, even though you still have the benefit of it, like as would be the case for human growth hormone or steroids. And there's, and for some urine testers, there are manipulations. You try and make it, provide different urine from your own. You try and make sure that the samples get degraded in some way, so that you're not going to get a positive test. There, I mean, lots of innovative things that can happen.
Do athletes actually inject clean urine into their bladders?
It has been done, yes. And the other thing they do is they have a different, like a balloon or a bladder that they insert, depending on whether you're male or female, into their anus or their vagina, with a little tube, and they provide the urine from that rather than their own urine. So some of it's fairly disgusting.
Yeah, and then just to extend the bad taste one more step, what's a whizinator?
A whizinator is a false penis to which is attached a sort of a catheter and another source of urine. That's one of the things that the NFL football player Ontario Smith was caught with. And it's clearly to avoid detection of doping substances in a urine test.
My guest is Dick Pound. His new book is called Inside Dope. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Dick Pound. He is chair of the World Anti-Doping Agency and author of a new book called Inside Dope, How Drugs Are the Biggest Threat to Sports, Why You Should Care, and What Can Be Done About Them. You know, one of the issues that's raised in this issue in professional sports and amateur sports is what is a fair penalty for a positive doping test. I mean, I think Major League Baseball now has finally come to a 50-game suspension, I believe, which is about a third of a major league season. What is fair, do you think, for someone who is clearly caught using performance-enhancing drugs?
Well, the consensus that we worked out when we put together the World Anti-Doping Code, which is kind of a, you know, we had sports that had gave a lifetime ban for the first offense, and we had some that sort of gave a two-week ban that you could serve between Christmas and New Year's. You know, I mean, a lot of different things. We settled on 2 years as being the normative penalty for the first serious offense of doping. And, you know, sometimes there are explanations and so on that might lead to a reduction of that, and in some cases even an elimination. But the professional sport teams just aren't interested in that. I mean, I think we could probably get them along to, you know, agreeing that the list should be the same and that the testing should be more rigorous and that there should be an independent results management service and so on, so that positive cases aren't getting hidden. But the thought of losing some star for 2 years over a little thing like drug use, in their view, is just out of the question. You know, the third of the season, a little less than a third of the season penalty in baseball is a big improvement over their first really tough, as they call it, program where the first time you got caught, you got counseling. I mean, I don't know what they would counsel you about being stupid or how to get around it the next time. The second time you tested positive, you might get a fine of up to $10,000, which is walking around money for some of these guys. This is the third time now you've been caught, you might get up to a 10-game suspension. And it really wasn't until you held up the same liquor store five times that you might face a suspension of up to a year. So that was clearly ludicrous.
You know, Dick Pound, you and I have never spoken, but I have to. I note that you you speak in measured terms and clearly think carefully about what you say, and yet your media image is a bit of a bomb thrower on this issue. I mean, you've created a lot of controversy, and I read in a piece earlier this year in the New York Times where you said that your job is in part to make it visceral. In another quote, maybe from the same piece, you said, "In a sense, I'm happy to be known by the folks that hate me." Is it your personality to be controversial, or your mission?
It's really part of the job description. I mean, what you're dealing with are pretty clear rules that everybody and rules that for the most part have been adopted with the interest of sport and the health of athletes. That's what the rules are, and you've got people who are cheating, and so that has to be confronted. I mean, you have to shine a bright light on it. You have to, you know, lift up the carpet and see what's under there. And there are a lot of people that are not much interested in having that light Sean or the carpet lifted. So it is confrontational. And the people who scream are not the athletes who are playing fair. And the visceral stuff is a way of trying to get the public at large to understand that this is a real problem. You know, and you do that by saying, you know, do you want your child to have to become a chemical stockpile in order to be successful at sport simply because there are a whole bunch of sociopaths out there that are prepared to ignore the rules? And people say, well, no, that's not what I want.
You know, I guess some of the controversial moments that have arisen involve cases where there are athletes who against whom there is some evidence of doping, but the case maybe isn't so clear. Marion Jones, the international track star in 2004, was, you know, the recipient. Well, there was a lot of circumstantial evidence involving her husband and, I guess, a boyfriend, and then eventually some grand jury testimony in the Bay Area lab case, but not a positive test. And some would say that in a situation like that, given the authority of your position as chair of the World Anti-Doping Agency, you should be careful about commenting until it's clear that you have a violation here.
Well, I'm very careful about what I say. I mean, I have to respond to questions. I mean, somebody in your business calls me up and says, you know, what's the story on Marion Jones? I can't say, gee, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I have to say what's out there. Circumstantial evidence is nevertheless evidence. And what I've always been very careful to say is that she has not been charged with an anti-doping violation. There is a lot of it. You mentioned something. I mean, there was a show on 2020 on ABC a year or so ago where Victor Conte said on national television, I sat beside her, I dialed up a shot of human growth hormone, I gave it to her, I watched her roll up her shorts and inject it into her thigh. You know, that's evidence of a sort. It's still, nobody has charged her with a doping violation, and she's entitled, and I've made that very clear, to the presumption that she has not doped until that happens. She had a case this summer where she had a positive A test for EPO, which was not confirmed.
Just explain for our audience what A test and EPO, what you mean. Yeah.
This EPO is short for erythropoietin, and it's a substance that is taken that stimulates the production of red blood cells in the blood, which means you can carry more oxygen to muscles and therefore improve your performance. When a test is done, the sample is divided into two roughly equal parts, which are called the A sample and the B sample. And if an A sample produces a positive result, which is what happened in the case of Marion Jones for EPO, she is entitled, as is every other athlete, to request that the B sample be analyzed and to have a representative present at that time. That was done, and the B sample did not confirm the A. We're not sure why yet. We're trying to figure out why that is. But the result is that there is no doping. The failure to confirm with the B sample cancels out the A sample, so she has not officially tested positive. All I've ever said, and this goes back to 2004, is that I hope the people that are looking after her interests have her best interests at heart.
Right, and I have to say, when I read the comments that you made about her, there was no case in which you convicted her before evidence was clear. I think it was the kind of comment where if this evidence is such, then serious consequences should result, like the removal of medals. You know, one of the questions hers and others raise is, what's the standard of proof that should bear upon an athlete who violates a drug use policy? I mean, I think a lot of their lawyers would say essentially they should be the same standards that one would use in a criminal trial.
Yeah.
What's your view?
My view is that this is not a criminal matter. This is a sport. These are all sport rules, and the standard of proof that has evolved in the sport jurisprudence is what's called a comfortable satisfaction with the evidence. So it's less than proof beyond all reasonable doubt and higher than a mere balance of probabilities.
Well, Dick Pound, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It was fun. Thank you.
Dick Pound chairs the World Anti-Doping Agency. His new book is called Inside Dope: How Drugs Are the Biggest Threat to Sports, Why You Should Care, and What Can Be Done About Them.